ערוץ 7. Hello everybody, this is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. And this is the program that begins on Sunday, the 3rd of June, which corresponds to the 20th day in the Hebrew month of Sivan. Hello to everybody, and of course to Mrs. Calabash. While I am recording this program in the middle of the week, there's an active war taking place on the border between Israel and the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip was handed over by the State of Israel to a terrorist organization and what was known as the Oslo Agreement. The Gaza Strip is one of the most densely occupied areas in the world, if not the most dense. There are almost 2 million people living in a very small area, which in itself does not create an explosive situation, because there are other densely populated areas like Singapore, and perhaps even the Bronx in New York or Manhattan in New York, that are not volatile because the governments of those areas know how to provide decent housing and employment for the people living there. Gaza is run by a group that is not only terrorist, but it's also corrupt. It steals most of the funding provided by the United States, the European Union, and several Arab countries. It pour billions of dollars into the coffers of the leadership. The leadership in Gaza provides no proper housing nor employment for its population. At the same time, it fills their minds with propaganda, and they have an educational system that brainwashes them to believe that all their troubles are caused by the Jews. The Palestinians are people who have known nothing but suffering ever since the Arab leadership made the disastrous decision to go to war against Israel in their name back in 1948. But the Palestinians are known to be intelligent and creative at finding ways to poke holes in Israel's security. For example, they send kites on fire and send them over the border where they burn up Israeli crops. Or they grab knives and hide them under their clothing and head for the border. They send boys and young kids to the front of the crowd so that Israel will look bad if they get hurt. The imagination of people in situations like this seems to have no limitation. Revenge, survival, is all they have to live for. But the Palestinians in Gaza have been treated the worst by the undemocratic leadership, which is essentially a terrorist leadership who purport to represent them, primarily Hamas. The Islamic group Hamas, which claimed to renounce its military wing in 2006 when it formed a political party, is behind the weeks of protests at right on Israel's doorstep. These were ostensibly about the right to return, which is the idea that all Palestinian refugees should return to live in Israel. But in reality, they were not that. They were a play for public relations by Hamas. For example, Hamas canceled school to augment the presence at the border of young people crossing into Israel. It's been said that modern states hold a monopoly on violence. Hamas holds a monopoly in sending its young people to be fodder on the global stage. At the same time of their official rise to power in 2006, it was argued that the Islamists, like Hamas, were ideal agents for bringing democracy to the Middle East, because it was they who represented the largest identity in the Middle East, not the Western-styled so-called Democrats educated abroad. But in the past 12 years since it came to power, Hamas has spent more time thinking up ways to cause public relations headaches for Israel than it has spent time improving the lot of its citizens. Why else would Hamas refuse humanitarian aid from Israel, which it has refused? Meanwhile, interestingly enough, and importantly, Palestinians were divided between the Gaza Strip and what they call the West Bank, to what we call Judea and Samaria. And it was given over to the Palestinians in the unfortunate Oslo Agreement back in the early 1990s. shortly after Hamas violently kicked the Palestinian Authority out of the Gaza Strip. So the Gaza Strip is now run by Hamas, and the Palestinian Authority ostensibly runs the area that's called the West Bank, and they'd be thrown out of power there too, but they are protected by the Israeli army. And when this uprising occurred over the last 6 weeks in Gaza, there was no response from the West Bank, which alone shows it was a Hamas conflict, not a Palestinian one. The leader of the Palestinian West Bank group, Mahmoud Abbas, has demonstrated his anger over the new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. He's recalled his representatives to the United States and four European countries. And if he plays his cards right, he may outlast the Trump administration. He's already, I think, 83 years old. And he knows if any future Democratic administration would get into power in Washington, they would probably be willing to recognize East Jerusalem as the Palestinian capital, because right now the Democratic Party has moved far to the left and is pretty much pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel. So in other words, they would have two U.S. embassies in Jerusalem. Such recognition could occur despite Israeli objections. Now, right now, Abbas has different goals than Hamas. Hamas clearly believes they had little to lose and only much to gain by provoking Israel. So you have to ask yourself whether this march from Gaza was really just a distraction to keep Israel from focusing on the more existential threat. Israel has a real existential threat, the possibility of a nuclear-armed Iran. What not only would become a nuclear power, but Iran already has a stronghold in the neighboring countries to the north of Israel, like Lebanon and Syria. Regardless, whether it's by design or something from the vantage point of Tehran, Israel is getting blasted in the news over Gaza at the same time when it desperately needs to get international support for a possible war against Iran and Iran's proxies in Syria and Lebanon. There's a phrase uttered at the end of Passover, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. It traditionally meant that one day the Jews would return to the Holy Land. But in effect, what's happening is that all of Israel's enemies seem to be saying a different phrase, next year in Palestine. To the Gazans, that apparently means rushing the border into Israel. To West Bankers, U.S. recognition of a Palestinian state with its capital in East Jerusalem is what they really means. And to the Iranians, it means a military invasion of the Jewish state. So Israel is facing these challenges. Which does it handle first? The answer is it has no choice but to handle them all at the same time. Although the different strategies employed by Israel's enemies have varying degrees of severity, they all in some way present a significant threat to the security of the state of Israel. And it's very, very severe problem. Now, it's a time to sum up, if you will, the so-called March of Return, which was the major thing happening the last 6 weeks. It's time to assess the results of the March of Return campaign, which probably might be another campaign. It'll take place after a temporary lull. There is a temporary lull now because we're in the fast month of Ramadan, and so therefore there will be probably no major activity. The biggest failure of Hamas was its inability to ignite the Arab residents of Jerusalem and those living under the Palestinian Authority in Judea and Samaria. Hamas is well aware that the power of the Palestinian problems, ironically, It's when they can properly use names that are found in Jewish and Christian scriptures, like Jerusalem or Bethlehem or Hebron, Hebron. But the Gaza and Khan Yunis or Rafiah, which are in the Gaza Strip, those names don't turn the Arabs on. The 6 weeks from the beginning of the campaign in late March through Nakba Day, which was May 15, were pretty quiet in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. The evidence for the passivity of that population is varied, but it is kind of conclusive. There are no major terrorist attacks in either Israel or the West Bank that ended lethally. In the 4 months preceding this campaign, there were 15 murders in Judea and Samaria. So any scorecard, the list of major attacks that ended in a bodily harm or material loss yields the same results. Before the campaign began, there were two per month in the area of Judea and Samaria. And then during the entire 6 weeks of the campaign, there was only one such attack. So the Palestinians living in Judea and Samaria simply were not interested in what was happening in Gaza. The number of news items over time relating to confrontations between Palestinian youth and Israeli army pretty much presents the same picture. There's a major media site of the Palestinians called Al-Quds. Al-Quds means Jerusalem in Arabic. Quds meaning the holy city. And they had a list of confrontations. In the 3 weeks preceding the campaign, there were 17 confrontations. Then there were only 8 in the first 3 weeks of the campaign. And finally, there were only 5 in the last 3 weeks of the campaign. The Gaza is preparing for demonstrations this Friday is a headline that appeared in Al-Quds, which is the Palestinian newspaper. It didn't say that the only Palestinians were preparing. It said Gaza is. In other words, not the Arabs, the Palestinians living in the West Bank. So there's a big split between the Arabs in Gaza and the Arabs in Judea and Samaria. There was a time back in the so-called First and Second Intifadas when residents of both areas took part in the violence. However, now the so-called March of Return essentially can be seen as deepening the divide that has existed between the Palestinian populations ever since Hamas's takeover of Gaza back in 2007. According to some of the experts, for example, there are experts in the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies at Bar-Ilan University. They claim that based upon their research, the divide is not only within the Palestinian political elite, which is Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, but there is a big divide on the popular level as well. Now, this is a major advantage to Israel. Violence is much easier to control when it takes place in either the Gaza front or the Judea-Samaria front, rather than on both fronts simultaneously, as has occurred in the past. Now, one of the major objectives of a weaker side in any conflict is to stir political division within the stronger side. This, by the way, is a very famous lesson in the French-Algerian struggle, in which the FLN and its army were militarily defeated but succeeded in bringing about deep division within the French public. And by the way, this popular divide ended in complete victory for the FLN, even though they were militarily defeated. Now, the Palestinians did much the same in the First Intifada when the Israeli public was sharply divided between left and right. That split, unfortunately, facilitated what became known as the Oslo process, the creation of the Palestinian Authority, and the move of the terrorist leadership, the PLO leadership, to Judea and Samaria from Tunis and elsewhere in the Arab world. In other words, the Oslo Agreement brought the terrorists from North Africa right back into our heartland, a major blunder on the part of the Israeli government, for which the inept Israeli leadership won the Nobel Peace Prize. I wonder if they have to give it back now. Anyhow, in contrast, the march that demanded the return of refugees to places near Gaza, like Ashkelon or Beersheba and Jaffa, clearly had the opposite effect on the Israeli public. Instead of being divided, Israelis rallied together behind the army's tough policy of zero tolerance for breaching the fence. So what worked for them back in the early 1990s is no longer working. And by the way, Hamas may have also antagonized its own hardcore. By its own estimation, the campaign cost the organization $10 million. For the past 4 years, Hamas has been paying its 50,000 employees only 40% of their salaries, which is roughly $500 a month. Now, having seen what's happening now, it could be that the Hamas-supportive hardcore will likely question Hamas's spending a great deal of money to wage this return campaign rather than distribute that money to the employees and their hard-pressed families. Fallout from the violence among the general population is also a problem. If the number of casualties is anywhere near true, and it could be that the figures are probably exaggerated, the vast majority of Gaza inhabitants, most of whom do not go anywhere near the fence, will likely question such bloodshed. Now they're facing exactly the same fence and the same reality that existed before this campaign. Those who did participate might have second thoughts about their sacrifices, which brought about no change whatsoever. The headlines in the English newspaper like The Guardian, The Times, and other British and European news outlets criticizing Israel, the condemnations dragged up from the recesses of UN and foreign ministry archives, and the rantings of the Turkish president against Israel were very small consolation to the people living in the Gaza Strip. So the campaign was clearly a failure. In truth, Gaza has tremendous attributes, including a strong workforce. The Palestinians are known to be among the most intelligent Arabs. The Gaza has access to the sea. It has proximity to Europe. These are tremendous assets that can be used once some sort of common sense prevails over the fanaticism that is what is happening in the areas under Hamas, and also the Palestinian Authority to a lesser extent. So Gaza could become a Singaporean vision of the Middle East, and it could turn the woes of human density into considerable economic, culture, and ecological benefits. Unfortunately, the leadership there is such that there's very little chance of that kind of thing of happening within the foreseeable future. It is unfortunate but true, and it is a problem that is right squarely in Israel's lap. And I hope our government has the sense to know how to deal with it. It is not an easy problem. So I'll be back after the break. I just want to give a review of what's happened in the last, let's say, 6 weeks, and what the result is. I'll be right back after the break. I mentioned previously that the Palestinians are doing their best, they're doing their present activities to get back on the agenda of the Arab countries, who are presently more concerned about Iran, because the strength of Iran and the threat of Iran really affects them. So they don't really care about the Palestinians. Nobody was surprised by the escalation, that Hamas has been searching for ways to get the Gaza Strip back to the world's agenda. So it made what they called the Great March of Return, but it had very limited success. Instigating a war with Israel is a better way to do the job. So Israel has to be careful how it responds. There are reports that the latest attacks were carried out by Islamic Jihad, which is a terrorist organization working with Iranian background, that are being supported by the Iranians. The enemies such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad use their own population as human shields. These terrorist organizations are pretty much based on the cult of martyrdom. They don't care whose blood gets shed. It could be Palestinian or it could be Israeli. They're quite happy if Israelis are killed. But an Israeli response in which Palestinians are killed, innocents or perhaps members of their organizations, such a response when Palestinians are killed is considered a victory. And it's a chance to put the Palestinians back in the spotlight. And one of the side effects, and perhaps the major effect, they can get more international funding while turning Israel to make Israel look like the bad guys. So the current tension could go either way, either further escalation or some kind of uneasy and informal ceasefire. Hamas is not openly claiming credit for these attacks, but it seized control of the Gaza Strip in 2007, so it has to be considered to be responsible. Hamas runs the Gaza Strip. Now, there are several international organizations or nations that are behind this because they support Hamas. This includes Iran, Turkey, and Qatar. So any effort to calm the situation has to include not only Israel but also Egypt, because Egypt shares a border with Gaza. The Palestinian Authority, which essentially rules in the Judea and Samaria after it was thrown out of Gaza, it's the sworn enemy of Hamas, and because it holds back funding, it's responsible to a great extent for the terrible conditions that the ordinary Gazan faces. You have to keep in mind, Israel withdrew entirely from Gaza in 2005. Israel uprooted 8,000 Jewish residents. And at the moment, by the way, Hamas is holding the bodies of two Jewish soldiers who were killed in 2004. And they're also holding two hostages, Israeli civilians who are being held there. So obviously, no solution to Gaza would complete without the return and closure for the families of both those who were killed and those who are being held. Now, an interesting thing is that there are a lot of, I guess you'd call it, sub-state actors that are in Gaza, and they're very effective, and they have to be dealt with. When we look into Gaza, at the built-up areas, you don't really see the enemy because embedded deeply in civilian neighborhoods, there are Islamic armed entities such as Hezbollah and Hamas. The same thing is true, by the way, of Lebanon. They're preparing themselves for combat. They're organizing their personnel into formations. They're pointing projectiles at Israeli cities. They're building underground tunnels and bunkers. And they're getting significant expertise in urban warfare. Not the clash of armies, but rather underground type activities. In the Middle East today, there are no big clashes of armies. That's been in decline for some time. So you have what's referred to as non-state actors or the sub-state actors. The problem is that these new actors are able to exert full control over the territories they govern, yet they make themselves nearly invisible when they chose to do so. This ability serves them both militarily. It's extremely useful in the areas of diplomacy and public influence. For example, Hamas has acknowledged in Gaza that the majority of casualties in the latest border clashes with Israel was in fact Hamas members in civilian clothes, some of which were armed. They were attempting to lead a mass infiltration targeting nearby Israeli communities and military positions. During the mass rioting, Hamas cells used civilians as a cover-up for cross-border shooting attacks on the Israeli army while others planted explosive devices. So operating among civilians is the way this kind of organization works, and it creates serious dilemmas for Israel. For example, in southern Lebanon, one out of every three civilian homes doubles as a Hezbollah weapons storage facility. In the Gaza Strip, Hamas has, during the past rounds of escalation, Hamas has fired surface-to-surface rockets at Israeli cities from hospitals, schools, and civilian residential neighborhoods. So right now, we can say that the days when the Israeli military could keep track of conventional enemy forces, and for example, when you look at other enemy forces, you can see the number of tanks and its air force and so forth. But you can't do this with a sub actor or a sub state actor. You don't know what they have. Today, Israel's senior military commanders speak of the need to deal with the modern invisible enemies, which are highly organized guerrilla terrorist armies, which are hanging and lurking in built-up areas. They're made up of infantry forces. They have rockets, mortar launchers, anti-tank missiles. They make tunnels. They mask qualities of automatic firearms and even have drones. In order to make such threats more visible, the Israeli army is developing an ability to deploy a network of sensors on the ground and in the air that can pick up a range of electronic communication signals on enemy activity. So it appears that organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah have made a strategic decision to decentralize themselves. But they do still have what the Israeli army commanders describe as centers of gravity, headquarters, if you will, that can be attacked. In addition, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, is equipping its forces with a range of new high-tech smart weaponry designed to precisely strike targets while minimizing collateral damage. These kind of weapons, backed by intelligence, could go a long way toward helping the Israeli army engage to this new battlefield. There are no signs at the moment that the other side is seeking a major confrontation. But although this may be unlikely, this is a very unpredictable region that could be dragged into a conflict, or even by mistake, at any time. As I understand, should this occur, the Israeli army will be better prepared than it has been in the past to deal with these invisible sub-state actors. Now, the international community, it seems, will continue to be susceptible to the manipulation of these radical non-state actors and their ability to make themselves vanish whenever they want to. So that's the situation. We're not facing normal armed forces. Now, the question comes up, what brought this all up, this violence of the last 6 weeks? There are those who claim it was Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. But I don't know how true this is. There's been an uptick in violence, and they thought this would, many people thought this would come about because of the moving of the American embassy, which essentially means the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Now, there's a group called the Meir Amid Intelligence and Terrorism Information Center. It's a big title, which is probably the most reputable source of data on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They've spent many years looking at the terrorist attacks that have been taking place. They define a significant attack. There's one that involves shooting or a vehicle attack or some kind of weaponry. This means that stones and Molotov cocktails thrown by Palestinians are not included. So we don't really know how much of this and what's happening was because of Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital, because the pattern of attacks before, in the 4 months before his announced the president's announcements, when did the president make his announcement? In December 2017. And the number of attacks is similar to during those 4 months prior to the announcement is pretty much the same as those following. This organization counts these kind of things. It's interesting how people seem to make a living counting attacks. At any rate, the summer months now, it's getting hot, generally include the most serious attacks. And for example, last summer, two Israeli policemen in a Damascus gate in Jerusalem were killed by Palestinian gunmen who began their attack from the Temple Mount, and they were subsequently killed. Now, this incident led to an Israeli decision to set up metal detectors on the Temple Mount, and that caused a tremendously aggravated and large Palestinian demonstration in July and August that went on until the decision was rescinded. In other words, the hot months, June, July, August, they're the months when the most probable that problems will occur. Another serious attacks. Data on serious attacks are probably not the best measure to assess what's happening. A good indicator of levels of forms of violence is the number of arrests that Israel makes. The problem is that the Palestinian organizations publish data about arrested Palestinians only on an annual basis. There is a Palestinian NGO called Admir, which claims to be concerned with the welfare of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli detention centers, and they keep a monthly record of the total number of these Palestinian prisoners, which is kind of interesting. There's been no real increase. For example, if you like to play with numbers, in September in 2017, there were a little over 6,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons. In October, a month later, there was less than 100 more, and roughly the same number in November. September, October, and November were the 3 months preceding Trump's decision to move the American embassy. Now, after the decision, which was in December, in January and February and March of this year, the 3 months after his decision, this figures actually show a slight decline in arrest, not an increase. Perhaps the best indication that Trump's decision did not bring Palestinians into the streets to confront Israel was the March of Return campaign, which began on Land Day and continued through May 14th, the date of the establishment of the State of Israel, which the Palestinians called the Nakba, the catastrophe. One might ask why there was a need to construct a campaign to mobilize Palestinians to violence if President Trump's decision had been so inflammatory. But more to the point, the Palestinians of Judea and Samaria, Israeli Arabs, and most significantly, 98% of the Gazans ignored Hamas's urging to participate, and they stayed home, which means it could well be that many of the Palestinians are simply tired of being forced into the streets. Of course, the Hamas pays many of them to do this kind of thing. But as I mentioned previously, there is a huge disconnect between the Palestinians in Judea and Samaria under the Palestinian Authority. There's a disconnect between them and the Palestinians in Gaza, which is under Hamas. They simply don't get along with each other to the very point where the Palestinian Authority is preventing goods and food to go into the Gaza area. So this is how they're showing their disconnect and their dislike for Hamas. Of course, the problem is that the ones who suffer from this is the average Palestinian who probably simply wants to make a living and feed his family. But this is the way it is now. There's a big disconnect between Gaza and the Palestinian Authority-controlled area in what they call the West Bank and what we call Judea and Samaria. And it's apparently very difficult, as we see with this great march, that the Palestinians and the Palestinian Authority simply don't pay attention to what Hamas wants in Gaza. So, which is interesting, by the way, when there are people who talk about a two-state solution, you have to ask yourself, who is on the other side to enable to make a state? Hamas doesn't get along with the Palestinian Authority. Palestinian Authority doesn't get along with Hamas to the point of violence between them. So who is going to stand up and make a Palestinian state? First of all, starting with the Oslo Agreement and billions was poured into them, they did absolutely nothing to create the infrastructure required to have a state. They simply poured the money into one of two things. Either they stole it off the top, the leadership of the Palestinians, or they poured it into munitions and building tunnels. So, as it's been said before, and I say it again, the two-state solution was never got off the ground. It was stillborn. Yet people are busy talking about it today, which makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. If the Palestinians, for example, had set up some kind of stable infrastructure with all the money that was given them to make a state, they would have set up something. There'd be somebody to talk to. But they simply use the money for their own purposes and for purposes of attacking Israel. So there's absolutely nobody there on the other side of the table with whom you can sit down and create a viable state, because that was tried in the Oslo Agreement and it failed. So I forget the definition of stupidity is to keep doing the same thing over and over and over and over and over again and getting the same result. And that's what's been happening. So everything that's happened since the Oslo Agreement is proof that there simply is no two-state solution. And the minds of Israel in particular have to get together and figure out what we do in this ongoing mess. I'll be back after the break. Jay Shapiro here. Hi again. While I'm recording this program, there's essentially a war going on Israel's southern border, the one that touches upon Gaza. And at the risk of sounding as though I am repeating myself, I think it's important to recall that the so-called two-state solution was stillborn. And it's essentially a solution that was never existed. I hesitate to use the word solution. I guess you have to call it the two-state proposal. It's important to have a little historical background. We see that the Arabs, particularly the Palestinian Arabs, and the whole Arab world at that time, back in 1948, never demonstrated a genuine desire for a state next to the Jewish state. In 1947, when the UN General Assembly proposed dividing Palestine, the Arab response was fiercely negative. At that time, there was nobody known as a Palestinian. As a matter of fact, the only people known as a Palestinian at that time were the Jews living in Palestine. A lot of them joined the British as the Palestine Brigade. At any rate, the Arab nations at that time in 1947 were violently opposed to the dividing Palestine into two states, because acceptance would have meant acknowledging a Jewish state. However, once Israel declared independence, the Arabs immediately launched a war. In 1964, that's already 15 or 16 years after the establishment of the State of Israel, the Arab League established a Palestine Liberation Organization called the PLO. Israel at that time was still small Israel within what they called the Green Line. The whole center of the country had been taken over illegally by Jordan. Jordan held Judea and Samaria, and Egypt held Gaza. In its charter, the PLO, which was organized, as I said, in 1964, renounced all claims against Jordan and Egypt. The only thing it sought was to liberate was Israel. In other words, when the PLO was founded, great parts of Palestine west of the Jordan River were being held by two other countries, Jordan and Egypt. So the charter of the Palestine Liberation Organization, the first charter, specifically said that it had no claims about Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, nor about Gaza, because they didn't want to start in with the with Egypt and Jordan. Perhaps start up would be a better word. They didn't want any trouble. However, in 1967, when Israel took over all those areas, they revised the charter and said that all of Palestine west of the Jordan River belonged to them. Now, in 1973, there was a war which was a watershed for the thinking of the Palestinians. It was apparent that Israel cannot be eliminated militarily in one fell swoop. And so while the PLO's ultimate goal of destroying Israel remained the same, it changed its tactics significantly. The PLO instituted what they called the phase program to weaken Israel one step at a time. They decided to liberate their land, what they called their homeland, step by step. Now, this program essentially gave the whole thing a semblance of moderation. Diplomatic negotiations were permissible only if they weakened Israel and they secured concessions. Now, it's with regard to this tactic that many people made a mistake. They failed to differentiate between a semblance of moderation and real moderation. The adherence of the two-state solution promoted territorial concessions by Israel in the belief that somehow a real peace will ultimately follow. Now, what did these advocates of the two-state solution believe? They believed that by making concessions, you show goodwill, and this will invite reciprocity. The Palestinian Arabs, on the other hand, sees concessions as weakness that simply invites further demands. It is a win-lose mentality. When Israel makes concessions, the Palestinian Arabs believe they're winning. For example, Yasser Arafat, back in 1994, made a speech in a South African mosque, and unaware that he was being recorded, he said, "This agreement, I'm not considering it more than an agreement which has been signed between our Prophet Muhammad and the Quraysh." Now, what was he referring to? Muhammad, back in the year 628, when he was first rising in power, made a peace pact with a tribe called Quraysh, which held Mecca in the Arabian Peninsula. However, after he got enough strength, he abrogated the pact, and he wiped out the Quraysh and took Mecca. Now, the Islamist and the Muslim world sees this as a model of how to behave with non-Muslims. Now, the PLO has been given solid proposal as a final deal twice. First, in 2000, Arafat rejected an offer by the Prime Minister at that time, Ehud Barak. They offered him 98% of the West Bank, and he turned it down. Again, in 2008, at that time already, Arafat was dead, but Mahmoud Abbas was the head of the Palestinian Authority, and he was given a very generous offer by our Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert. And he turned away, walked away from it. So the bottom line is that the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, will never sign a final agreement with Israel. This is in part because it would mean agreeing to end the conflict. The PLO leadership is committed to continuing the battle with Israel until Israel is destroyed. And by the way, they fear assassination by their own should they renege on this. In other words, if any Palestinian leader shows that he's willing to compromise with Israel, the chances are that his head will be separated from his shoulders. So what is one to do then? There's an oft-cited Muslim belief that land once possessed by Muslims is Islamic land forever. And Palestine was for many centuries occupied the Ottoman Empire, which was a Muslim empire. So our responsibility is to seek a realistic and humane solution to the conflict of Palestinian Arabs. But it's not going to be easy. We have to realize that they will never accept us, and we have to work around that. Now, what is the proofs? You know, if you look, as I like to say, under the radar, you find interesting things that indicate what they really think. So I want to say a few words about the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority receives funds from the United States and from the European Union. In other words, and this is important, Americans and Europeans are funding Palestinians who are opposed to any form of normalization. The Palestinian problem is not with settlement or a checkpoint or a fence. They have a problem with the existence of Israel on any borders. Palestinians have still not come to terms with Israel's right to exist, period. This is what they preach in their mosques, and this is what they teach in their schools. This is the essence of the Israeli-Arab conflict. They see Israel, the Palestinians see Israel, as one big settlement that needs to be destroyed. Now, for example, the Palestinian leaders have spent the past few months calling for boycotts of Israel and also boycotts of the U.S. because the United States moved its embassy to Jerusalem. The most recent call came just a few weeks ago when the Palestinian Authority leaders and the officials called on all countries to boycott the inauguration ceremony of the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. Now, they preached to their people day and night hatred, incitement, and boycotts. I want to give an example, a concrete example, so that the listeners will understand what I'm talking about. It's always good to have a concrete example. There's a guy by the name of Ahmad Majdalani. He is a member of the PLO Executive Committee. Now, he is being accused by his own people for promoting normalization between Palestinians and Israel. So the question is, what crime did Majdalani actually commit, and why has he become the subject of a boycott? It turns out that this guy, Ahmad Majdalani, committed two crimes in the eyes of the Palestinians. First, and this is the first crime, listen to this, he accepted an invitation to attend the annual Herzliya conference organized by an Israeli think tank. This Israeli think tank is called the Institute for Policy and Strategy. That's his first sin, that he agreed to attend their conference in Herzliya. The second sin was he was asked to comment on the criticism from Palestinians for his participation in the Israeli conference. And he said, "My participation in the Herzliya conference is not different from my participation in events organized, for example, by Bir Zeit University." Bir Zeit University is right outside Ramallah. So here he compared an Israeli academic institution to a Palestinian academic institution. By the way, the annual conference is held at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, which is a research college near Tel Aviv that was founded in 1994 based on the model of the American Ivy League universities. Now, this guy Majdalani had attended the Herzliya conference in the past. He faced strong condemnations for agreeing to be part of a conference organized by an Israeli think tank, but he wasn't, not the way he's being severely punished now. This time, his critics decided condemnations were not enough. He's been handed a severe punishment. He's been banned from entering or speaking at any Palestine university, or because he wanted to attend an academic conference at an Israeli university. For example, the chairman of the General Workers Union at Palestinian universities announced that his union has decided to boycott Majdalani and not receive him at any university campus. He said the decision would be reversed only if Majdalani, who is a senior PLO official, apologizes for equating a Palestinian university and an Israeli educational institution. As I said a moment ago, Majdalani said attending a university in Israel is like attending Bir Zeit, a Palestinian university. But for making this a comparison, he's being punished. The decision to boycott Majdalani came right after the union's opposition to any form of academic normalization with Israel. And the head of the union said, "Our union will work hard to hold accountable any official or academic who is involved in promoting normalization with Israel, and we will ask all Palestinian universities to boycott him or her. Any Palestinian academic who commits the crime of promoting academic normalization with Israel will be punished and banned from setting foot at any Palestine university." The workers' union at Barzit University issued a similar call for boycotting this guy. The union was really furious with any senior PLO official, not only because he attended an Israeli conference, but also because he dared draw a parallel between Bir Zeit University, which is a Palestinian university, and any Israeli educational institution. The head of the Palestinian Union, said any Palestinian who is caught involved in promoting any form of normalization with Israel would be subject to punitive measures and boycott. There is no room for normalizers with Israel on our campus. These are the people. This is the academics within the Palestinian Authority. So now, PLO officials permitted to enter any Israeli university, and they become persona non grata at Palestinian universities or other academic institution, simply because he made a comparison between a Palestinian university and an Israeli university. It's worth noting, by the way, that those who took the decision to ban him for entering, and he's no longer allowed to enter Palestinian universities, are now these people who are living under the Palestinian Authority, which is considered moderate compared to Hamas in Gaza. It wasn't Hamas who bans anybody for normalization with Israel, but it's the Palestinian Authority, the one which is considered to be moderate. Now, this is the same Palestinian Authority that receives funds from the United States and the European Union. In other words, American and Europeans are funding Palestinians who are opposed to any form of normalization with Israel. For these Palestinians, it would be better if Israel simply disappeared than having to engage in any kind of collaboration with Israel. Anyone who opposes normalization with Israel is actually acting against peace with Israel. How can there be peace between Palestinians and Israel if Palestinians are opposed to any kind of normalization? This leads us to one conclusion, that the Americans and Europeans who are pouring money into the Palestinian Authority are funding Palestinians who seek the annihilation of Israel. The Palestinians' anti-normalization campaign against Israel means that the Palestinians are not interested in peace with Israel. What they seek is not peace with Israel, but they seek peace without Israel. They want to see Israel gone from the Middle East. They want to see Jews vanished from this region. They're being funded by the European Union and the American government. The bottom line is that the problem the Palestinians have is not with a particular settlement or a particular checkpoint or a fence. They have a problem with the existence of Israel and any borders. They had the same problem since 1947 when the UN declared that there should be a Palestinian state and a Jewish state. Palestinians simply have still not come to terms with Israel's right to exist, period. That's all there is to it. This is the essence of the Israeli-Arab conflict. They see Israel as one big settlement that must be destroyed. The Palestinians, and I repeat that, the Palestinians since 1947 have not come to terms with Israel's right to exist. That is the bottom line. The controversy surrounding the participation of a Palestinian leader in the Herzliya conference could serve as a useful wake-up call to the entire Western world. If a PLO official's visit to a conference in Israel is considered to be treason, what would happen to a Palestinian who actually signed a peace agreement with Israel? There's absolutely no education for peace with Israel on the Palestinian side. Rather, decades of Palestinian education for war with Israel and preaching from the in the mosque every Friday against the existence of the state of Israel translates into an Arab-Israel conflict that cannot be resolved by concessions on the part of Israel. The other side only sees concessions as weakness. And no wishful thinking on the part of anyone will change this reality. These are the hard facts. And so all these people who come up with all kind of solutions, including the so-called two-state solution, are simply not basing their belief on actuality. And I've said this before and I repeat it now, as long as the educational system under the Palestinian Authority, which has been brainwashing the Palestinian kids since the Oslo Agreement more than two decades ago, as long as these kids are grown up with the belief and the education that Israel has no right to exist, we have to find some kind of solution which will take into account that fact. And that solution will probably take many years to implement for the simple reason that it's not like the Second World War or any other kind of war. We have a situation where the people on the other side, the Palestinians, are being educated and preached to that we have no right to exist. And on that foundation, understanding that, we have to figure out what to do. It's certainly not an easy situation. And it's not going to be resolved simply, but I would like to think that some of the best minds in Israel are working on it. I don't know if solution is even the right word. We have to figure out some way of getting along, living with this reality that the other side simply does not want us to exist. It's hard to accept, but these are the facts. I'm sorry I had to repeat myself. I've probably said this many times, but it's got to be repeated because you keep seeing headlines and articles about all kinds of solutions. But if you don't take into account the basic problem and you don't solve the basic problem or learn how to deal with the basic problem, there's no point in using even the word solution. I'll be back after the break. Okay, you're back with Jay Shapiro, and this is the last segment of the program. And since the first three parts of the program have been pretty heavy and serious, I do what I like to call under the radar. And these are articles that I collect during the week, the various newspapers here in Israel, the Hebrew papers, the Jerusalem Post. And these are little articles that appear in the sidelines. They're almost like fillers. But in a sense, they give color to what's actually happening. So these under-the-radar articles today, and again, these articles have absolutely nothing to do with each other. It's just, as I said, they give a background picture. I guess I like to use the word color, depth and color, of what's happening in the Jewish world. So I want to start the first one that has to do with asking people in Europe what they think about having a Jewish member of the family or a Jewish neighbor. And it says like this: nearly a quarter of British respondents to a poll on attitudes to minorities in Western Europe said they would be unwilling to accept Jews as family members. The Pew Research Center's report titled, the title of the report was Being Christian in Western Europe, was published last week, and it contains results for interviews with more than 24,000 randomly selected adults in 15 countries. Now, in the United Kingdom, 23% of the respondents interviewed said no when asked, would you be willing to accept Jews as a member of your family? It was the second highest proportion of people who said no, directly after Italy's proportion, which was 25%. In other words, and by the way, the poll has a margin of error about up to 3%. So you could say the United Kingdom and Italy were pretty much the same. Roughly a quarter of the people interviewed said that they would not want a Jewish member of the family. And by the way, the highest level of acceptance of Jews as family members was in the Netherlands, where 96% of the 1,500 respondents said they would have no problem with a Jew joining their family. In Germany, 19% said they would not accept a Jewish relative. In Austria, non-acceptance was 21%. The mostly Catholic nations of Spain, Portugal, and Ireland had high non-acceptance levels. Spain was 13% would not accept a Jew. Portugal said 18% would not accept a Jew. And Ireland also said 18% would not accept a Jew. By the way, the same question was asked about Muslims, and their acceptance was even lower than that of Jews in all the 15 countries surveyed. There was a median difference of 10% points. So Jews are unpopular, but the Muslims are even more unpopular. In Italy, 12% of the respondents said they were unwilling to accept a Jewish neighbor. In Ireland, 10% would not accept a Jewish neighbor. In Portugal, 9%. In the United Kingdom, and also 9%. Spain, Germany, Switzerland, and Austria, 8% said they would not want to have a Jewish neighbor. The statement, and this is the statement they were presented with, Jews always pursue their own interest and not the interest of the country they live in. This statement received the highest levels of agreement in Portugal and Spain. Portugal was 36%. And Spain was 31%. Behind that were Italy, Belgium, and Norway, with 31%, 28%, and 25%. So Jews are not too popular in Europe 75 years after the Holocaust. The only compensation the Jews have is that the Muslims are even more unpopular. The next item has to do with the showing of Israeli flags at Arab sports events. A team of leading international jurists, including Harvard professor Alan Dershowitz, planned to petition the International Court of Arbitration for Sport against the exclusion of Israel's flag and anthem at sporting events in Arab countries. By the way, I didn't know there was such a thing as International Court of Arbitration for Sport, but it's interesting that there is such a thing. Dershowitz is a well-known defender of Israel, said that it starts with sports, but it won't end there. We won't allow the Jewish state to be treated like a second-class country. This is a national humiliation and a surrender to terrorism. The Arab world is trying not to recognize Israel through sport. We have to fight this discrimination on every front, legal, diplomatic, political, and even economic. We have to make sure this discrimination won't have sponsors and funders. If we don't stop this, the phenomenon will enter all areas of our lives. No country in the world would be willing to have its athletes hide its flag and anthem. Israel must demand that international sport associations and athletes around the world take part in our struggle. So here you have it. The Arabs don't like to have Israeli flags seen at any of their sports. Interesting enough, I wonder how the Arabs would feel if in any particular sports event the Israeli team did poorly. Wouldn't the Arabs want to feel good about the Israelis doing poorly? I think They don't want the Israeli flag to be shown for two reasons. First of all, they don't particularly care for Israel. And second of all, they're afraid the Israeli team might be good. And if the Arab team's lost, it would be a terrible humiliation. And humiliation is one thing that is extremely dangerous to suffer in the Arab world. You have to remember that many things in the world and cultures depend on shame and embarrassment. And that's a whole story I don't want to go into now. There's a different attitude in the Arab world than in the Western world, and even in particular countries in the Western world, the attitude toward embarrassment. But that's a subject unto itself. Western culture is built pretty much on guilt. People can be can feel guilty even if nobody knows the bad thing that they did. On the other hand, in the Arab world, shame is the major motivator. So if you do something bad, nobody knows about it, you're okay. In the Western world, if you do something bad, nobody knows about it, but you know about it yourself, then you feel guilty. The Arab world, the Muslim world, doesn't look upon guilt, it looks upon shame. Again, as I said a moment ago, that's a story unto itself that maybe we'll talk about it sometime in the future. In the meantime, let's go to the next item. There's an organization called the Center for World University Rankings. It's initiated in Saudi Arabia, and it's headquartered in the United Arab Emirates. No, I never. It's another one of those things that I never heard of before, but that's simply my ignorance. Anyhow, this Center for World University Rankings has ranked the Weizmann Institute of Science here in Israel among the top 50 degree-granting institutions in the world. The Hebrew University of Jerusalem and the Tel Aviv University were also ranked in the top 100. Hebrew University was 61 and Tel Aviv University was 85. Among the factors that contributed to the institute's overall ranking are quality of education and quality of faculty. So a key factor in the rankings, when they're looking at these universities, a key factor is research, and Israeli institutions will find it increasingly difficult to compete in the future with American and European research-intensive universities if the Israeli government does not increase its spending on scientific research, which is like done in the other countries. By the way, the U.S. and United Kingdom University rank as the top universities in the world. And just as a point of interest to the listeners, the top 10 are Harvard, Stanford, MIT, Cambridge, Oxford, Berkeley, Princeton, Columbia, the California Institute of Technology, and believe it or not, University of Chicago. These were the top 10 spots in this ranking. They rank up at something like more than 600 universities and colleges. Incidentally, the University of Chicago is the place where the first time in the history of the world that a nuclear experiment was done, and it was the seed that led to the development of the atomic bomb. Nuclear fission was first accomplished at the University of Chicago during the Second World War. Anyhow, so Israel only got two places in the top 100. By the way, there are two other Israeli universities were evaluated, Bar-Ilan and University of Haifa, and I'm too embarrassed to tell you where they appeared in the list, but they weren't too high. Again, this has to do with the amount of money which is invested in research. In a bill approved on Sunday by the Israeli Knesset, it hasn't gone to a vote yet, but it'll probably pass. The bill states that all educational institutions will be made free of major allergens such as peanuts and nuts and required to adapt themselves to food-sensitive youngsters. The bill states that schools will have to adapt the environment to food-sensitive students that food and educational institutions must be free of products that contain or may contain allergy-causing foods such as peanuts and nuts. The more acute the allergy, the more the school, kindergarten, or nursery will have to take all the necessary measures to prepare for it, and they have to post signs and guide the parents and children. In addition, food suppliers to the institutions, including caterers and vending machines, will not be allowed to sell food with the allergens. A supplier who does not comply with the provisions of the law will be subject to financial sanctions. You have to keep in mind that allergic children are entitled to full integration in all educational works. So this is an important bill that we can only hope would be the first step in making the lives of allergic children safer in educational institutions. Now, I don't know what's happened in other countries, but I think Israel can be proud of itself for making this kind of legislation. All kids have a right to be healthy and to be socially integrated, and this is what the bill intends to, that's the purpose of the bill. The next item has to do with something that appeared in the Journal of Physiological Reports, and I'm sharing this with the listeners because I think it's a problem that I might have myself. If you're having trouble sleeping at night, that is, if you're having trouble getting to sleep at night, be due to using a tablet computer before your bedtime. This research was done in Boston. They found that the evening use of light-emitting tablet computers can induce delays in when a person wants to go to sleep, suppress secretion of melatonin, which is the hormone that regulates sleep and wakefulness, and impair next morning alertness. All kind of people participated in these studies, and they found out that the if people use these light-emitting tablets in the evening before they go to sleep, they had trouble sleeping. And it's very complicated about melatonin levels, and they have delay in when they go to sleep. When they get up, they don't sleep as well. So if you use laptops and smartphones at night, you might be in trouble. They have biological effects, and using light-emitting electronic devices in the late evening can even postpone your decision to go to sleep and make you more sleepy the next morning. Now, this has nothing to do with Israel or the Jewish world. I admit to that. But I found it very interesting for the simple reason that I suffer from that problem myself. And, you know, years ago when I first came to Israel, it was, I'm talking almost 50 years ago, it was pretty standard that businesses closed in the afternoon, like from 1 to 4 or from 2 to 4, so that people could take a nap. They could have lunch and take a nap. And now we're in a more modern society, and these stores are open day and also day and night here in Israel, like in other places in the world. So people are having all kind of new problems that are developed from modern devices. And since I share in this problem, I thought I would let the listeners know about. So don't look at your computer too much in the evening before you go to sleep. You might have trouble sleeping. Here's another interesting non-related article I found in the paper the other day. It might be interesting to the listeners to note that the Security Cabinet of the Israeli Knesset, which is a forum of senior ministers headed by the Prime Minister, has begun holding its weekly meetings in a secure underground bunker in Jerusalem. This underground bunker is known as the National Management Center. It has been around since 2011. It was first used by the Security Cabinet then to rehearse a national crisis scenario. This Security Cabinet shelter is beneath the government complex in Jerusalem, and believe it or not, it includes living quarters as well as command facilities. So meetings of the cabinet which used to be held mostly at the Prime Minister's office in Jerusalem, are generally held out of the public eye, and they're held in this secret area. One of the main reasons for the move is because the Prime Minister is trying to prevent leaks. Now, I don't know how meeting underground can prevent leaks of information, but anyhow, the place includes places to sleep. So it's very interesting, you know, like during the Second World War, the British had an underground area where the cabinet met. And today, if you go to London, you can visit it as a tourist. You can be shown around the place where the government met during war. So now you have the same thing happening here in Israel, because, you know, we are, unfortunately, the city of Jerusalem is within rocket range of the areas that are not friendly to us. And it's nice to know that our ministers can meet in security and be confident, according to this report, that the information spread around in the security bunker won't get leaked out. I'm not quite sure how it's kept from leaking, but if I find out more, I'll be glad to tell the listeners. Most of the leaks are by cabinet ministers who shoot their mouths off, but that's a story unto itself. And I'd like to close out this program with something more optimistic. There's been a downward trend in heart disease mortality rate. Unfortunately, there's been an increase in Alzheimer's, and it could well be because people are living longer. Years ago, people died before they could get Alzheimer's. Anyhow, the report was just put out, and it said the mortality rate adjusted for age is lower in Israel than in the U.S., Canada, and most European countries. Israel has the second lowest overall death rate for men in 25 European countries, and only Switzerland has a lower rate, which is interesting. Nobody is threatening the borders of Switzerland, and they have a lower rate than Israel. But other than that, all the other European countries have a higher death rate for men. And women are ranked seventh lowest among France, Spain, Italy, Switzerland, Luxembourg, and Canada. So the age-adjusted mortality rate is lower in Israel than the U.S., Canada, most European countries for cancer, heart disease, liver disease, Alzheimer's, accidents, and suicide, believe it or not. From the years 2013 and 2015, only 2 years, the suicide was the second leading cause of death among males aged 15 to 44, and the third among women of that age group. So I don't know what that all says, except here we are in a country that is, I think the interesting thing is that here we are in a country surrounded by enemies who want to destroy us, and the only one that has a lower death rate is Switzerland, which has no known enemies. And I think the thing about Alzheimer's, I'm saying this as a non-professional, that the longer you live, I guess, the better chance you're going to get Alzheimer's. Years ago, people died too early to get those kind of things. At any rate, I'm not sure if this is an optimistic or a pessimistic note to close the program, but I thought all these little under-the-radar items would be interested to listeners because they give a little background and color to what's happening here. So until next time, this is Dave Shapiro saying thanks for listening. Take care of yourself. Let's hope we have a quiet week. And best regards to Mrs. Kallenbach. Take care of yourselves. I will change.